This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
The following wrestling exhibition requires discretionary viewer participation.
Hello and welcome to episode 21 of Greetings from Allentown. I am your host, Peter Winston, and today we're going back to 1986 for some Universal Wrestling Federation action. And of course, this is the good version, not the Herb Abrams edition. We're talking the Bill Watts edition of the UWF. And that is quite the funky little theme song that they have there. And Mid-South had different themes through the years. I know it was a different one that I did back in episode 11, which is the other Mid-South / UWF show that I covered from March of 1984 with Bill Watts and Jim Cornette at war. But Bill Watts is fighting a completely different war on this show, although it is something of a cold war. But first, some plugs of how you can reach out to me. You can find me on Twitter, at which I am the most nimble, social media-wise, at GF Allentown Pod. You can also find me on Facebook, where I am slightly less nimble, at facebook.com/greetingsfromallentown. I'm trying to post more stuff there, share some photos and all that stuff. But I'm never going to be as adept at Facebook as I have been at Twitter, because I've been using Twitter since 2010 and I've been using Facebook for about 5 weeks. So there's kind of a difference there in terms of my knowledge base coming in. And of course, you can email the show at greetingsfromallentown@gmail.com. And to close the book on last week's show, WWF Wrestling Challenge from July 11th, 1993. I did get one notation about the Raven / Scott Levy and his career being one of a kind from listener Greg Sirota, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. On the subject of wrestlers who became big stars after managing, I'd say the most prominent example is Diamond Dallas Page. And for some reason, I didn't mention DDP, but I think I was trying to go with the very strange arc of being a competent wrestler, as Raven was, as Scotty Flamingo and Scotty the Body, and then he becomes a manager and then leaves managing and becomes an even more successful wrestler than he was before. I was trying to remember if DDP had matches in the AWA. He might have been as a manager, but he was probably nothing more than a low-level guy, at least in terms of being a wrestler. Certainly not anything like Scott Levy was in his pre-Johnny Polo days. But today, okay, UWF 1986... But before I get to that, there's a topic, and it's kind of an elephant in the room, because it came up, well, it started happening as I was recording last week's show, as I was finishing everything up. And the show, we maintain a playlist, a Greetings from Allentown playlist on YouTube, which contains the episodes that I have covered on this show. And you may have noticed about a week ago, all of a sudden, a bunch of those just disappeared from view. And the cover photo, which I believe defaults to whatever the first episode's screen cap was. And in my case, it was Roddy Piper and Adrian Adonis in their little flower shop Piper's Pit face-off, which was the initial episode of Greetings from Allentown back in the archives. You can find that on SoundCloud or on iTunes. And don't forget the Pro Wrestling Only feed. I'm kind of going off track here, but many great shows on the Pro Wrestling Only feed. I know this past week, a lot of the G1 United States special. I haven't really had time to watch any of that. In fact, I was watching Glow on Netflix last night as that was going on with the Cody Rhodes-Okada match. Maybe I'll catch up with it at some point. back to YouTube here. A lot of the stuff now is gone, and it was one user who's I was a source of many episodes that I'd done. Most prominently, the Bruno Sammartino, Larry Zbysko episode would have never been possible without that user's uploads, because there was no way I was ever going to be able to cull together all that stuff. Luckily, though, I mean, there's still a lot out there to go through. I have stuff, you know, in a collection now where if the whole thing went nuclear and everything went dark, if YouTube ended tomorrow and all video sites, even like Dailymotion, which I may start using more going forward, if all of that shut down, I would have enough material for another year of shows. So about 52 more. And I spent mornings kind of putting together a list like that. And there seems to be no real rhyme or reason to these takedowns on YouTube other than going after maybe the most prominent or the larger users. So to uploaders out there, I would probably just suggest, stop at a certain point and lay low for a while, and that'll be that. I just don't want anybody to get into trouble or whatever with that. But it really sucks, because being a wrestling fan is kind of a journey. And, you know, I've had stages of my fandom, and the journey is in discovering these new things that you haven't seen before. I've mentioned in the past my watching of 1984 WWF TVs, mainly, you know, Championship Wrestling and All-Star, last summer on YouTube, and how that kind of led into the development of this show. But with this, the UWF, I'd never seen any of this stuff, because living in the Northeast, and also I didn't become a wrestling fan until 1988, so the UWF and Mid-South was only something I would see referred to in magazines. I would see that, oh, the one-man gang used to be the UWF champion before he came to WWF. And that is, or Terry Taylor was the UWF television champion before he became a Rooster character. It's stuff like that, and I would never actually get to see. I would hear about, oh, this was good stuff, but there was no mechanism to really share, other than, of course, tape trading, which I never really got into all that much, probably because technologically I'm not the most adept guy. The show has decent sound, but I think that's more of a happy accident than anything else. So yeah, I'm kind of jealous of those in other areas of the country who maybe started watching a little bit before me, who are the same age as me, maybe started watching at 5 or 6 years old. Those who live in like southeastern United States, where you could pick up, say, the Joe Pedicino block in Atlanta on Channel 69, that would show all these different territories, the Continental, Deep South, Memphis, even WWF, I think, was part of it for a while. And you just get to see all these different things. Whereas my experience in the Northeast, I would read about it in the magazines, but it would be WWF, and we could see NWA, WCW once TBS came to the area in late 89, at least was my experience. But the only territories outside of that were the crappy AWA on ESPN and World Class, which was also on ESPN and admittedly did have a presence in the Boston area. World Class ran shows in Boston and had, you know, but it, by the time I had started watching, World Class had really just kind of faded for reasons that everybody seems to really know. And Mid-South, part of their issue, I think, even though they had the amazing television show that was well ahead of its time, with Joel Watts, Bill Sun working in production, and he did a fantastic job on the production elements. I didn't really like him as a broadcaster when they would throw him out there. There were certain problems with being called Mid-South. The story goes that ESPN chose the AWA because one of the executives looked at the roster list and had actually heard of Sergeant Slaughter. But another reason for that is that Mid-South was a very regional-sounding name, whereas the American Wrestling Association gave off a vibe of being national and bigger. So they went with the lesser promotion, and I don't think anybody can say that the AWA in, say, 1985, 86, was better than Mid-South. And it makes me wonder if Bill Watts, if they had changed the name to the Universal Wrestling Federation back, let's say, January 1, 1985, if things had might have been different for them. Another thing that could have changed the game for them is if they could have stayed on TBS. They got kicked off TBS in early 85 when Jim Crockett bought the time slot back from Vince McMahon after the whole Black Saturday fiasco and the WWF's no other way to put it, failures with the TBS show. And that took place around the same time as the first WrestleMania. And what had happened was Mid-South was running a show in the mornings on TBS that was very, very popular, and in fact, probably more popular than the WWF show. In fact, I can say it was most certainly more popular because it was a style of wrestling that the southern United States was more accustomed to. But as part of the Crockett deal, Mid-South got thrown off of TBS. And it just makes you wonder if Mid-South could have held on to that time slot, how things would have been different. Now, I can't really go through all the reasons for why the UWF ended up failing. I touched on some of them there. If you want to know more, I would suggest checking out the Exile on Bad Street podcast, and it was the second episode called The Death of the Universal Wrestling Federation, and of course, Exile, hosted by Chris Zellner, and his guests on that one were David Bixenspan and Dylan Hales, and that podcast was actually my introduction to all three of them, and I don't know how I happened to come upon it back in 2015, but it was about a three-hour show discussing how the UWF really tailed off in 1986 and then the circumstances surrounding the Crockett purchase of the UWF in April of 1987 and what you saw with guys leaving and how the UWF, they were going to keep it as kind of a separate brand. That sounds familiar. But Jim Crockett, they immediately killed the territory off by having all their guys come in and win all the championships almost immediately. You had Big Bubba Rogers come in and beating the one-man gang in a weird heel versus heel match so that a mid-card Crockett guy, which is what Rogers was, beat the UWF's, I guess, nominal top star since the gang was the world champion there. There are other problems with the UWF that, you know, that kind of led to their demise. A lot of it, and I've talked about it, was the local economy slumping due to the oil glut in the United States during that time frame, which caused oil prices to drop precipitously, I think down to like $10 a barrel or something like that. But also the UWF, and this was a model for wrestling during the mid-80s, is that they were paying for their television time slots everywhere. And in their attempt to go national, they're paying to get on all these stations. And that's something less than ideal, because in order to make it work, you've got to have house shows in these cities that you can advertise. And not only that, you got to get people to come out to those house shows and make money on it. And the UWF was not really doing that well with these house shows that they were running outside of their area. And even in their area, they were facing increased competition that they didn't really have as much of in, let's say, 84 and 85. I'm just thinking in Houston, Texas, which is the biggest city within the UWF's kind of purview, you had the Houston Rockets and the Houston Astros, who neither of which were particularly good in that 82 to 85 time frame. In fact, the Rockets were kind of the first version of the, quote, process that the Philadelphia 76ers have been doing the last few years, getting the first overall pick in 83 and 84. You had Sampson and Olajuwon. Well, by the time 86 rolls around, the Houston Rockets are a really good team with Sampson still healthy and Olajuwon coming into his own. They make it to the NBA Finals. And the Houston Astros, I was reminded of this because as a gag, I sent a Mike Scott baseball card to a New York Mets fan friend of mine. And the Astros won the National League West in 1986. So they had returned to the playoffs for the first time in, I think it was about 6 years. I don't think that they had made it since 88. They might have made it in the 81 strike season. So the attendance was up in those areas, and the UWF's attendance was well down. I'm not saying that that was a huge reason, but they're facing competition there. But this angle we're going to see on today's show, the big angle, the Bill Watts Russian flag angle, as it's known, it comes off on television as the hottest thing you will ever freaking see in a wrestling ring, with the fans just screaming and the babyfaces trying in vain to save Bill Watts from these evil Russians, and the way Eddie Gilbert set it up. It was beautiful. But the problem is it didn't really draw all that much money. And they were getting diminishing returns on, let's say, their Superdome shows over the years. Example, Bill Watts had come out of retirement in 84, 85, 86. The attendance numbers were dropping each time for their main New Orleans show. In 84, the number that they drew to the Superdome was around 23,000. That's an approximate number that I've seen. But for the Superdome show for Bill Watts' return match to get his revenge on the Russians here, the number is more like 11,000. So you're down by half from where you were 2 years before. And of course, New Orleans had really fallen off as a wrestling town because the Junkyard Dog was kind of the king there. And once he had left the Mid-South territory, it started to fade from being a New Orleans territory into more of a Oklahoma / Texas territory. The TV taping here is in Tulsa. It's taped May 25th, 1986. And of course, as I said, Houston, with along with Paul Bosch, running the shows at the Sam Houston Coliseum. So really, I mean, without any further ado, I mean, that's the big angle here. And we got a lot of guys who are very early in their career appearing on this show. We have Dr. Death Steve Williams. Of course, he's part of the big babyface entourage running in to save Bill Watts after he had been beaten down there. We also have a very, very young Rick Steiner in action, and he's actually facing a Percy Jackson, who would go on to somewhat greater fame doing other stuff in his career. We also have Ted DiBiase. Of course, he would be in the WWF a year from now, and I did a special on that about a week and a half ago on the 30th anniversary of the first Million Dollar Man vignettes. And we also see the Fantastics in action later on as well. And on commentary, of course, we have Jim Ross, the standard of UWF television there, and he's alongside Michael Hayes, who had only recently taken over from Bill Watts as the commentator there, and the Freebirds were in the midst of their big UWF run. So let's just jump right in. Fun fact about me, when I got married in 2010 and I'm standing up there doing the vows and all that stuff, that was the song that was actually stuck in my head, the do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do- match, which is Rick Steiner versus Perry Jackson. We get a little clip from a week or two prior, which is Michael Hayes being very upset that Ted DiBiase is broadcasting one of his matches. And DiBiase says, well, I can fix that. He heads down to the ring, and eventually that is actually going to set up a tag match later on the show, which is DiBiase and Terry Taylor taking on the two Freebirds who are there, which would be Buddy Roberts and Michael Hayes. Now, Rick Steiner, at this time, he's accompanied by Buzz Sawyer, who is still presented as the television champion here, although he was about to lose that title. In fact, it happened on this taping and would air on the next week's UWF show, Terry Taylor winning the title off of Buzz Sawyer, who is something of a mentor here for Rick Steiner. I'm not so sure how wise it is to have Buzz Sawyer as who one of the all-time flakiest guys in the history of the business as one of your mentors. Of course, he was one of the people who's to train Mark Calloway, the Undertaker, and just showed him, I guess, how to lock up, and then kind of walked out and disappeared with the money that had been paid. And of course, Sawyer passed away at a very young age back in 1992, and he was just everywhere at one point or another. Like, seeing him on WWF television in 1984 was such a shock, because I never would have thought that he would have been there. And he only made about two or three televised appearances before he Buzz Sawyered his way out of there. And we all know Rick Steiner, and he's very, very young here. He's only 25 years old and still quite a bit green. But Perry Jackson, and I thought that I recognized him from somewhere. And, you know, it's, again, my journey as a fan and kind of in doing this show, I love finding out the back history of these guys and finding out, oh, this guy actually has wrestled in the year 2017, teaming up with New Jack, of all people, down in the VIP promotion down in Arlington, Texas. And that blew me away. Here I am, I'm watching this guy as, you know, a fairly young guy in 1986 working in the UWF, and he's still wrestling in the current period, although obviously not very regularly. And Perry Jackson, he was trained by Bill Watts and Dusty Rhodes, so that's a hell of a duo to be trained by. And he became Action Jackson about a year or two after this. Actually, it would have to be at least 2 years after this, because Action Jackson was a movie that came out in 1988. It was a vehicle for Carl Weathers, since he couldn't do any more Rocky movies, since they had killed him off in Rocky IV in 1986. So he becomes Action Jackson. And I have not seen that movie in a very long time. And to kind of refresh my memory of that, I kind of looked up the info on it. And I was also reminded that the bad guy in that movie was Craig T. Nelson. And that's something that I miss very much, Craig T. Nelson being a bad guy and stuff. All the Right Moves is kind of the evil coach of the team there. And he was also the nemesis of Action Jackson, which, by the way, has a Rotten Tomatoes rating of 10% fresh on that site, which is one of the lower ones that I've ever seen. But he would go on, and he would work in numerous places, teaming up with Iceman Parsons in Global as the Blackbirds, and also on the Texas independent circuit, where he is a bit of a legend of that, of the Texas independent scene, because he was one of the main guys there for a very long time, well into the 2000s. In terms of WWE, he never really did anything other than a handful of matches as a job guy and a couple of TV tapings. He lost to the Warlord in 1990, I think it was, and as a on a dark match on a 1997 Raw from San Antonio, it would be the July 14th Raw, he beat Rod Price in a dark match. Now, I don't know if this was a tryout for him. I was unable to find anything that would indicate that, but it's just kind of interesting that that was there. But of course, the match taking place in San Antonio, and both he and Rod Price are very familiar to the fans there. He got kind of a big break in WWC in the 1989 time frame, working with TNT, who is most familiar to American fans or WWE fans as Savio Vega. And they had a great feud as Jackson was going by the original TNT and facing the real TNT, Savio Vega. And they had a feud in 1989, and Jackson had actually left before they could have the blow-off, apparently, because there was Hurricane Hugo came through Puerto Rico and kind of delayed things there. The original setup to that feud is looks like it was very well done, and I owe a debt of gratitude to El Barriqua on Pro Wrestling Only, who kind of gave a history of this feud. Is what had happened is Chicky Starr had brought in the quote original TNT and claimed that Savio Vega, the real TNT, was an imposter. So this sounds familiar with the Undertaker versus Underfaker angle that came years later in the WWF that everybody hated because it just didn't come off well at all. And this is the complete opposite. And in my research this morning, I watched a couple of their matches that one of them from 89 where Savio Vega TNT was put out by original TNT and didn't wake him up after putting him to sleep, which is the courtesy that would be done if when you would put a guy out with the sleeper, but he did not do that. And then, as I said, he left for a while, came back in 91, and they had a couple of great brawls that are out there on YouTube as well. I think the name of the uploader, it's like WWC Classics. I know I usually don't say who the uploader is anymore, but I should try to get a link to that at some point. And this is something I wouldn't have ordinarily sought out and watched. So it's part of that journey that I was talking about in terms of, you know, seeing and discovering new things. I think the only Puerto Rico match that I've watched in the last year or two would be that completely random Rick Martel versus Terry Funk match that took place in a baseball stadium in 1986. But yeah, definitely check that out. Of course, TNT ended up winning the feud in March of 91, winning a match with the stipulation of the winner gets to keep the TNT name. And, you know, Perry Jackson, Action Jackson, he worked, like I said, still working up through 2017, which is a pretty remarkable accomplishment. But before we get into the match here, we get an interruption after the introductions from Eddie Gilbert, the head of Hot Stuff International. And he had been, in the previous weeks, he had been associated with the Blade Runners, who, of course, we know as the Ultimate Warrior and Sting much later, but they're in their much greener state at that time in 1986. And Gilbert was also associating with the Russians. And by Russians, you get a mix of really good Russians, Ivan Koloff, Nikita Koloff, who were kind of on loan due to the partnership of the UWF and Jim Crockett Promotions that was kind of going on at this point. And then, of course, there's also Korchenko, who I'll get to later. But Korchenko was beating opponents left and right, and then he would lay the Russian flag, or the Soviet Union flag, with the hammer and sickle over the defeated opponent. And this would enrage good old boy Bill Watts, the angry grandpa on the couch of professional wrestling. And there was a brawl that had broken out a couple of weeks prior, and right here, Eddie Gilbert wants to apologize to Bill Watts and says that he's seen the light and would like to speak to him. He says, "I am not a communist," which I found kind of funny for some reason. And I, again, it's probably one of those Simpsons things where it just reminded me of a Simpsons line from the past.
"My Homer is not a communist. He may be a liar, a pig, an idiot, a communist, but he is not a porn star."
So anyway, Gilbert has the flag with him, and he wants to apologize, but we get no Bill Watts for right now. And Michael Hayes on commentary is takes a rather interesting tack with this, stating that he feels that it's a First Amendment right for Eddie Gilbert to do what he's been doing.
He doesn't have to. Did you see that? That's bureaucracy. That's red tape. That's Watts going overboard with him being the president of this company. This is a free country. It's run on free enterprise. Man's got a right to do what he wants, whether I agree with him, you, Watts, or anybody else.
People often say stuff like that where, well, it's a free country. I should be able to say whatever I want. No, it doesn't really work that way, okay? The First Amendment says that Congress shall establish no law. And what that means is that the government cannot prohibit your use of free speech. Of course, you know, you can't yell fire in a crowded movie theater, this and that kind of stuff. But if he's technically working for Bill Watts, I guess as an independent contractor, maybe something that maybe that would affect things here. But Bill Watts, since this is his company and he's the president of the Universal Wrestling Federation, he can run things as he sees fit. So if one of the people under his employ or independent contractor, you could just let him go, he has the right to kind of set a standard of what he expects. So if he doesn't want the Soviet flag there, that's his right. So really, Michael Hayes' commentary here has no real basis in reality. And we get Tommy Gilbert, who is a referee in the UWF, and he comes out and he talks to his son and they just kind of have a conversation. You can't really hear what is being said here. And then he just leaves. And Hayes is very disgusted by this, that Eddie Gilbert is going to back down to Bill Watts. So he's really kind of pushing that envelope there. JR does say that Steiner has a bright future in the business, and it's another one of those Jim Ross moments where it did turn out to be correct, although I do think if you ask somebody how big they thought Rick Steiner might come to be, let's say in 1988, in his part of, you know, that varsity club angle that culminated in Starrcade 88 and actually carried in 89 a little bit, I guess, you would have thought that Rick Steiner would have ended up being a bigger deal than he ended up being. It's just really a tag guy. So not quite as prescient as Jim Ross's remark. I don't know if it was Halloween Havoc 91 where he said this, where if there was a draft of all the young guys in wrestling, that he would have made Stunning Steve Austin the first pick, which probably the most prescient thing that Jim Ross ever said. Two guys exchange slams here. Steiner does have the edge, and then he pulls up Jackson rather than going for a pin, and then another power slam pulls him up. We get like a crossbody type spot. This seems to be really weird lately with screwed up crossbodies. I think it's like 3 shows out of 4 now where we've had something like that. You get a slugfest and a backdrop by Jackson, and then a slam, but only a 1 count there. So it's a really quick match here to put over Rick Steiner. Of course, we get no interference from Sawyer on the outside, except for a pretty good slap early in the match on Jackson. He actually regains control with a kick to the gut after Jackson had a little bit of offense. And Jackson actually ends up on top, and he kind of gets caught coming off with a belly-to-belly, which kind of looked a little awkward. But, of course, Rick would use the belly-to-belly to great acclaim. And, of course, on last week's show, he approaches the Yokozuna Body Slam Challenge and attempts a belly-to-belly suplex, which really left me scratching my head. But that's a Steiner brother for you. Right now, we have the one-man gang, a future UWF world champion. He's taking on Ken Massey, who, I must advise, is not the Ken Massey who is an American sports statistician who's come up with a rating system for all manner of different sports. This is just one of your usual Mid-South UWF enhancement guys of the time period. And the gang, they actually throw it to a promo in the back for him. And I've noticed that gangs, maybe I'm just tying on to people's hair lately with Pillman's mullet and Owen's hair. The gang's hair is a little bit puffier than usual. You wouldn't expect to see that long of a hair to be part of a mohawk. And you would expect maybe, you know, put a little gel in it to make it, you know, not quite so puffy. It just looks a little weird. It doesn't look like the one-man gang that I know and what I grew up with. And he's in the back, and he kind of cuts a generic big guy promo, like, hey, I'm here, I'm going to squash everybody, da-da-da-da-da. But the big news is that he will now be a part of General Skandor Akbar's Devastation Incorporated. And what's funny is when we get back from the promo, Hayes says that one-man gang is a guy who speaks for himself. He doesn't need anybody to speak for him. It's like, okay, well, he's taking on this manager, Akbar, who is presumably going to speak for him in the future. So it's kind of a contradictory message you're giving me here. One thing I did find interesting on the gang's vest, of course, he would wear that jean jacket vest that would say Halsted Street on the back. Halsted Street, a major thoroughfare in the city of Chicago. And he's wearing a button, a Chicago Bears World Champions button, which I just thought was really strange, because you figure he probably likes football and all, but you don't think of this monster heel as also being a sports fan like anybody else. And there's not a whole lot to speak of here. I criticized the gang in the Ted DiBiase special because he was looking a little bit slow in that match. I don't know if he got bigger between here and then. He did look a little bigger, I think, in 1987, but it's not like he's some sort of spry, you know, guy here. He's certainly well over the 400-pound mark. It just looks like he's moving around a little bit more normally, at least for the one-man gang that I'm used to. Now, if you are watching this match, I hope that you would have paused it before, say, you went to the bathroom or went to grab a drink or something, because it's over really before you know it. Massey ends up on the floor, gets some clubbering forearms on him, gets thrown back in, you get a slam, and then the big splash, and that's how he picks up the win. I don't know how I would compare his big splash to, say, King Kong Bundy's, which was the same era, although I did notice in this match that the gang is wearing one knee pad, and it's one of those things that just bugs me for some reason. Like, why is he only wearing one knee pad? And that was something that Bundy, very late in his WWF stay, I think it was one of the Saturday Night Main Event matches with Hogan, either the late 87 one or the January 88 one, where he shows up with one knee pad, and all it just makes my mind crazy. Like, what happened to the other knee pad? Is this some kind of signal? Is this like the Buddy Landell not wearing knee pads as his signal that he's not going to be doing any bumping? Like, I really want to know what's going on. But those two guys, the gang and Bundy, kind of two sides of the same coin, I guess. Of course, they would be on the same Survivor Series team in 1987 and would both get beat by Bam Bam Bigelow before Andre came in for the big win. But One Man Gang is building his way up and making his way up the ladder in the UWF. And of course, he would win the world title less than a year later, but it would not be the most grand world title victory, as it was by forfeit over Terry Gordy. So it was not something that really made the gang feel particularly strong as the company's champion. Now, at the end of the gang match, Jim Ross had said he's got to make his way to the ring to interview Dark Journey. And Michael Hayes, seeing the opportunity to get together with the lovely Dark Journey, decides to invite himself along for the interview. And Dark Journey is a very interesting case, because I had heard so much about her in ways that had nothing to do with wrestling before I would have ever seen her on television. She predated my time as a wrestling fan. I knew of her first from the NWA, being very, very briefly at the side of Tully Blanchard. And also, I knew she had some sort of run-in with Missy Hyatt, and they did have a feud in the UWF. And Missy talks about it in her book, which I had mentioned a couple of weeks ago on the WCW main event show from December of 1990. But Missy and Dark Journey, obviously two women maybe vying for the spot of top woman in the UWF. And Missy did not particularly care for Dark Journey one bit. She tells the story about how Dark Journey went and, quote, shacked up with Sting, and then Sting got the crap beat out of him by Dick Slater, who then left the promotion shortly thereafter. But let me just give you an idea how what Missy thought of Dark Journey from her book. Working with Dark Journey was a nightmare from the very start. I mean, I guess I was a little spoiled from my experience with Sunshine, who always worked light and easy. But Dark Journey was the worst. She beat my ass every night. It didn't matter how much we rehearsed our moves ahead of time. She would chase me around the ring just like we rehearsed it, and she would grab me by the hair just like we had rehearsed it. And then she'd get a pop from the crowd, and she'd just snap. The adrenaline would get to her. She'd hear the crowd roar, and then suddenly it was like she went into vapor lock. And yet, she goes on to talk about how Dark Journey was a little bit, well, more than a little bit rough with her in the ring. And right here, we got Dark Journey with JR and Michael Hayes, who has invited himself along. And she had had a little run-in with Mad Maxine and Jack Victory, which kind of was her babyface turn in the promotion. So Journey's promo here, very generic. I'm coming to get you, Lady Maxine. I'm going to get my revenge. I'm going to smack you down. All that sort of stuff. And then she just turns to walk away. And that seems, okay, well, that's a little weird. But Michael Hayes, he's now going to step in here. And he... Michael Hayes' voice on commentary and his voice on the promo, for some reason, sound very different to me. I don't know how that happened, where Hayes' voice on the commentary sounds like he just smoked like a pack of cigarettes. It's very, very gravelly, but it sounds more like normal Michael Hayes when he's doing the promo with Dark Journey here.
You do not need to worry about this Lady Amazon. You do not need to worry about Jack Victory. You see, I understand frustrated women, okay? Now look, listen, baby. All you need to do is come take a journey down Bad Street with me.
And Hayes says, well, you know, I'm not going to marry you or anything. And Journey slugs him. And it looked like a pretty good slap there. I'm not sure that Hayes would have complained about it in a book or anything, but he was certainly prepared for it. And they show the replay of it, and the replay is just fantastic because you can see Michael Hayes start to flinch ever so slightly right beforehand. And Jim Ross, off to the side, he makes this face of, like, who farted? It's just really, really funny, the whole thing. And this would actually carry on down the road. There'd be a kissing angle with Hayes and Dark Journey down the road. And it's kind of funny that Hayes here, he's all outraged in the ring. He's like, she's just playing hard to get. She's just playing hard to get. And I'm laughing because given what we know about Dark Journey and some of the things that have been said about her, whether truthful or not, she did not play hard to get on a particularly regular basis, as is my understanding. Just listen to what people have had to say about her during this time period.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the Pro Wrestling Only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rizzero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlayStation.com, and we offer those to you on three great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the original Place to Be podcast, as well as Main Event, Lucha Afterground, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows, as well as the Our Vantage Point podcast and Jeff Learns Wrestling. In addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver quick-hit pod blasts on topics old and new.
Over on the Pro Wrestling Only feed, we dive deep inside the wrestling business with a stacked army of experts leading the way. The feed features potpourri shows such as This Week in Wrestling, Greetings from Allentown, Psychology is Dead, Puro Potpourri, Stacy and Elliot's Bogus Journey, and the Military Industrial Suplex. We also have shows that focus intently on certain topics like Letters from Center Stage, Space City, an NWA Classics On Demand adventure, Through the Years, Strong Style History, Strong Style Story, and Mount Olympus. Plus, the feed has the full archives of legendary shows like Titans of Wrestling, Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Kayfabe, and much more. And on our popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, PTBN Dadcast, Go Home in a Box, NBA Team, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversation, Geek and Sassy, and Imaginary Stories podcasts.
You can find all these current shows plus archives of our past podcasts, including the Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to all of our feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows plus others available on PlacementNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlacementNation.com/Amazon when shopping online, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, in Fall River, Massachusetts, TheHistoryOfWrestling.com, and Scott Keats' Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlacementNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Earlier on, I was mentioning how this angle with Eddie Gilbert, Bill Watts, and the Russians didn't really draw money, but was so red hot as it happened. But I do want to add that it was extremely well put together, and I know that Eddie Gilbert is got this incredible stature among the quote-unquote IWC, and he did certainly have a great mind. He came up with a lot of great angles, and this was one of them. And his performance here, and knowing what Bill Watts is as a person, I mean, it was well established that he was doing the let's kill those commie bastards and, you know, let's do this and that, kind of like very anti-communist, anti-Soviet Union, was a real staple at the time. I mean, think of, you know, Ronald Reagan as president, at least in his first term, where it was, you know, a very hard stance against the Soviet Union. That's kind of what Bill Watts represented. So the segment here, it starts out, Gilbert is in the ring again, and he's wearing a color shirt that personally I don't think I could ever wear, because I don't think that color ever looks good on me. But as for Eddie Gilbert's looks, for some reason, I don't know if it's the hair and beard combo, he looks a lot like Ted DiBiase to me, which is weird because Ted DiBiase, we're going to see him momentarily. And also it's funny because if you recall, many episodes ago on Greetings from Allentown, I had confused Eddie Gilbert in the opening of 1983 episodes of Championship Wrestling. I confused him with Bob Backlund. So I've confused him with, you know, I think he kind of looks like DiBiase and Backlund at various points. Well, I guess a mini DiBiase and a mini Backlund, because he's obviously a much smaller guy than either one of them. And he wants to apologize to Bill Watts again. And this is part two here. He says that this didn't just happen overnight, that he's come to realize, his mistakes. And it's the way he puts it when Watts finally does come out, and he said that he was going to stay in the ring until Watts came out. So Watts comes out, he gets a nice round of applause, and he says to Watts that he did it for the money. A lot of what you do in wrestling is for the money. And then he starts playing on Bill Watts's, I guess, emotions, where I don't need this flag. Because Bill Watts had been really hung up on the whole flag thing, putting the flag over the defeated opponent of Korchenko and all that. And he actually gives Bill Watts the flag as a gesture. Now, if you're putting yourself in Eddie Gilbert's shoes, you're giving him this flag. You've now turned Watts' mind off to anything that might happen. You've basically turned off his, I guess, suspicion radar, because he's handed him the Soviet flag, and immediately they both decide, hey, if you want to, Gilbert suggests, hey, if you want to burn it, and of course this gets old conservative Bill Watts all, yeah, let's burn it, and, you know, so his guard is completely down. And he then vows that you will never see him, this is Gilbert to Bill Watts, that you're not going to see him with the Russians ever again. He'd still be with the Blade Runners, who, by the way, have just made their way out to that front aisle where people would come out of on the Mid-South show. They would come out from the near side. And I've noticed what it seems to be on the programming is the heels would go around, they would walk up that aisle, and they would go around to the left side, and the baby faces would go around to the right side. And he says that you won't see him with the Russians, he still will manage the Blade Runners, and then pointedly tells Bill Watts that you're a great man. So he's firmly brown-nosing Bill Watts here. It's really a textbook way of ingratiating yourself with an authoritarian type figure like Watts.
I'm disassociating myself with the Russians. You'll never see me with the Russians again. I'll still be with the Blade Runners, though. I will still be with the Blade Runners. They're my team. They're the greatest tag team in... That's okay, boys. I'm just telling Mr. Watts that I have nothing more to do with the Russians. I don't want to see that flag anymore. You're right. I was wrong. You are a great man. And in the past few weeks, I've been very stupid and very foolish, and you're great.
I'm stupid. You're smart. I was wrong. You were right. You're the best. I'm the worst. You're very good looking. I'm not attractive.
I play the clip from Happy Gilmore just because what Eddie was saying reminded me of that scene where Happy goes to Chubbs and asks for his help in learning how to play golf. So Watts is holding the flag. He holds it up facing one side of the ring. And then all of a sudden you get a commotion. You see him throwing a right hand. And what that is Ivan Koloff has hit the ring now, and they came from the crowd, so this is a complete ambush. And then you get Nikita Koloff and Korchenko, and they beat him down, and they start choking Bill Watts with a chain, and they hold him up so that Eddie Gilbert can hit him with a shovel, which appropriately is colored red, and that busts Bill Watts wide open. And the beauty of this is the commentary, which I'll get to in a second, and I'm going to play it in its entirety, because this is something that a lot of people got pointed to this, including me, when Paul Heyman was on Steve Austin's podcast. It was a couple of years ago. It was either 2014 or 2015. He pointed to this as the ultimate Jim Ross call in terms of how excited he was on this. Michael Hayes starts praising the brilliance of this plan, so Hayes is playing his role well, as good as well. But JR loses his absolute mind, and he got a lot of criticism at that time. I guess he won some sort of award called the I Can Scream the Loudest Award. I think it was from the Observer. He actually shared it with David Crockett of the Jim Crockett Promotions. And but Jim Ross, you know, this is one of his more famous calls, probably his most famous UWF call. I know these days JR took a lot of crap for his commentary last Saturday night on the New Japan special on AXS. He was taking a lot of heat from people that I follow on Twitter anyway. But he is really worked up about what's going on here. And Ivan, of course, Ivan Koloff is somebody, he passed away earlier this year. There was a great interview with Ivan done on the Titans of Wrestling. You can track that down in their catalog. You can find it on the Pro Wrestling Only SoundCloud page. He starts biting the cut, and that's always like a cool move to like really put over just how violent and deranged the heels are. Any sort of biting of cuts. I know it's a little bit gross, but it struck me that way. Actually, I guess it was Nikita who was biting on the cut, but my whole point still stands. So they're stomping him, and they start whipping him with the chain, and Eddie has got the flag, and he's unfurling it, and they're holding Bill Watts down. Now, you're probably wondering, where the hell is the babyfaces like Dr. Death, you know, the closest ally of Bill Watts? Where the hell are they to save him? Well, Dr. Death, Ted DiBiase, and Hacksaw Jim Duggan, they're detained in the aisle because the Blade Runners are blocking the way, and the two of them are fighting the three guys and presumably executing some sort of zone blocking scheme because you got two guys blocking three. Now, eventually they do overcome, but not before Watts is held down and Eddie Gilbert just lays the flag on Bill Watts. And JR just loses his absolute mind.
Gilbert hit Watts with a shallow, man. He transplanted it.
Boy, you know what, man? That makes me go to sleep better tonight. He had me fooled. I thought he was Bill on
that. The Russians are taking over on Watts. Gilbert sucked Watts in.
Look, he's biting that head.
The Koloffs and Cortino.
He hit him again. What a plant. That's almost as good as any Bad Street plant.
They're whipping the cowboy with that chain.
See,
it's stopping him.
He got out of his position. He should have known not to mess with wrestlers anymore. He's a president.
Look at Gilbert.
He's showing that flag. He never intended. Fighting Duggan. There's a fight back here in there.
But they put the flag over the cowboy. Look at that.
Look at that.
I can't believe it. Nothing's ever happened like this.
The flag's over him. And he doesn't even know it. He's knocked out. The worst nightmare in his life. He's knocked out. Look at the fight going on. The Blade Runners are holding him off. Here comes Doc.
Watts is bloody in the flag. Land on him. The Russian flag. The cameraman's been knocked around.
They're holding him
Duggan
off.
Duggan and Williams and DiBiase trying to
here
come
goes
in.
Duggan. A good right hand. They wouldn't have got rid of us, but they still did a number. Look, he's out, he's down, and he's got that flag for a bit.
They had the flag on, they better bury him. They better put him away right here, I'll guarantee you.
It looks to me like they did.
If he is breathing, they better go ahead and finish it. They put that Russian flag on him.
I'm of the belief that commentary matters. If you have a bad match, but if you have good commentary, it at least makes the thing watchable, in my opinion. If you have good commentary, that'll always add to a good match. Kind of like how if you have a good steak, a good quality steak, and if it's cooked perfectly, for me, say a medium rare, that makes it even better. If you have good sides on it, that's what commentary can do. And this particular, Like I said, it did not make as much money as it might have otherwise. If it was 2 years before, it probably would have made just as much, if not more money, than The Last Stampede did in 1984. But this is an example of commentary helping to make a great angle even better. Now, the postscript for this is rather interesting. Obviously, Watts and them, they would get their revenge at the big Superdome show going forward. And, you know, Ivan Koloff, obviously one of the legends of the business. Nikita Koloff would go back to Jim Crockett. He would win the United States title off of Magnum TA as part of that very memorable feud that actually culminated in Nikita turning face after Magnum TA's accident that fall. But what about Korchenko, who seems to be known as one of the quote-unquote worst Russians in wrestling history, which is unfair because you have to consider the AWA Russians, which were always the worst ones. And once again, I'm going to turn to Missy Hyatt's account here, because I think she'll be true. She has no reason to be less than truthful here, because Missy Hyatt hates Bill Watts. So why would she be defending his honor or anything? So you had a match later on after this that was Bill Watts versus Korchenko, with the stipulation being that Watts gets 5 minutes with Eddie Gilbert if Watts won the match. The match lasted 2 or 3 minutes before Bill put Korchenko in kind of a hold, and the referee forced a rope break, apparently, and Korchenko took that opportunity to run out of the ring to the back, to his car, and he took off, never to be seen again. That is actually courtesy of the outlaw J.D. McKay in a thread on WrestlingClassics.com. But Korchenko would land on his feet outside of the world of wrestling. You may or may not know this, but he actually has been on television since then as one of the guys in the reality series Big Rig Truckers. And I always found that interesting that this guy who played a fake Russian in the mid-1980s would reemerge a quarter of a century or so later and just be one of those guys on reality television. Before the next bout, which will feature Dr. Death Steve Williams, I should add a little something. You had the baby faces kind of helping Bill Watts up off the mat, and Watts' sons went into the ring. So this is probably the greatest wrestling-related thing that Eric Watts was ever a part of. And even then, he was upstaged by his brother Joel, the producer, in his very canary yellow pants that I can even pick up through, you know, the standard definition video quality. I don't know, his pants really sort of stood out. This is why I'm here, to notice stupid little crap like that so that I can pass it along to you. As mentioned, we got Dr. Death now, and he is taking on erstwhile Cuban import Gustavo Mendoza. And he actually does something in this match that would earn him induction into the WrestleCrap Hall of Fame. And I'll get to that in a second. We got Dr. Death. He runs the ring, actually hops the fence. He doesn't go fully around to the right like the baby faces usually do. And he's coming out to Born in the USA by Bruce Springsteen, a song that came out in 1984 on the Born in the USA album, which was Springsteen's biggest to that point. It was a little different from some of Springsteen's earlier work. Of course, I've been to so many Springsteen shows, although I didn't start going to them until the Rising Tour, but I think I've been to 17 or 18 of them now, and I do feel like I have a good understanding of Springsteen's music. And by the time Born in the USA came along, he was starting to get a little bit more overtly political, but Born in the USA, the song itself, was misunderstood by so many people, from the columnist George Will, who famously wrote an entire column misinterpreting the song back in August of 84, and then Ronald Reagan name-dropping Springsteen in a speech when the whole album is kind of a cry against the era of Reaganism. My Hometown, you know, there are other songs on there, but there's kind of a poppy veneer on these songs. Like, the beat of Born in the USA makes it sound like a upbeat, happy-to-be-American song, but you have to listen to the lyrics, of course. And the best way to do that is Bruce released a different version of Born in the USA. It's called the Nebraska version, which was the acoustic solo album that he came out with in 1982, and he had originally recorded Born in the USA for that, and it's just him on acoustic guitar, and you get the feel of the song that it's about a Vietnam veteran who has come back and things are just not going his way. So people misinterpret that song, and it got used for Dr. Death Steve Williams, and also in his team with Ted DiBiase. The WWF also used the song for the U.S. Express duo of Barry Windham and Mike Rotundo. Isn't it funny that two guys who would go on to become part of a team called Money Inc., DiBiase and Rotundo, would end up using a song like Born in the USA? But that song was always just really kind of misunderstood. You just need to read the lyrics on that. And I'm just glad I was able to cram some Springsteen talk into this. I know that he probably didn't really care much for having his music used on this. And commercial music in wrestling, with the exception of Heyman's weird ECW backroom deal that he had where he could somehow use all that music, the WWF phased out using real music around this time and went to the Jim Johnston and kind of stuff from the Pile Driver album, something more under their umbrella. So back to the match here. We got Dr. Death, and he's wound up like crazy, and the crowd is on edge because this is after the Bill Watts beatdown. And you have the Cuban Mendoza in there, and he's not somebody who was pushed at all. He was just kind of a jobber foreign baddie in the Watts territory for about a year through 1986. Steve Williams comes in, and he just starts wailing on Mendoza, but Mendoza still has the cigar in his mouth. And this is what he was inducted into the WrestleCrap Hall of Fame for, is for keeping that cigar in as he's taking like three, maybe four flat back bumps. And he bails to the outside, and you can see actually the cigar still in his mouth. And when he comes back in, Dr. Death headbutts him, and that's where the cigar falls to the mat. So he was unable to keep it in for the entire time. That's what she said. So we get Dr. Death with a couple of shoulder blocks on him. Of course, JR loves this because, you know, the football moves guy from Oklahoma, he's getting a certain tumescence in his pants, I think. And he's just laying out Mendoza. And this is a real fun squash to watch after seeing the good old US of A put down in the previous segment. And he picks Mendoza up for the Oklahoma Stampede Power Slam. And he nails him for the 1, 2, and 3. And this is certainly memorable. Mendoza with the cigar in his mouth for that long. And Dr. Death, you know, he would be the UWF champion, the last one that there would be under the Jim Crockett banner in 1987, and then they just kind of phased out the title while he was working in Japan. Of course, he got into a little trouble with some drugs and whatever. I don't really want to talk about that. But isn't it weird how we never got that unification Dr. Death Steve Williams versus Ric Flair match? Doesn't that seem like it would have made a lot of sense? I don't know. It makes sense to me. In lieu of the musical interlude here, what they do on the show now is they kind of cram in a little ad for Bring the UWF to be part of a fundraiser for your local charity or group or whatever. And JR's got Frank Dusick there. And this ad is kind of interesting. Something really struck me here.
Attention nonprofit groups and organizations. Here's a great fundraising idea. Mid-South Sports Universal Wrestling Federation will work with you in raising much-needed funds. If you haven't considered using America's premier sports entertainment event...
Whoa. Did I just hear the words sports entertainment uttered on a Bill Watts wrestling show and not a Vince McMahon wrestling show? Wow. I need to get myself a drink of water. I've mentioned that UWF's television production is very, very good. Joel Watts, of course, was a huge part of that. And I don't know what happened here with the guy who does the chyrons for the wrestlers, you know, the labels, spelling out of the names, but I think somebody slipped him or her a quaalude, because we got the Fabulous Freebirds coming to the ring, and as Michael P.S. Hayes jumps into the ring, his first name is spelled wrong and his last name is spelled wrong. Michael is spelled M-I-C-H-E-A-L. Then we get PS spelled correctly. So that's good. At least we got the middle part correct. And then the last name is spelled H-A-Y-S with no E in it. So it's spelled like the guy from Airplane. And I don't know what happened. They did manage to spell Buddy Roberts correct. So good for them there. And Freebirds, of course, running hot in the UWF for pretty much their entire run. They're taking on Ted DiBiase and Terry Taylor. And they come out to Bad Reputation by Joan Jett. And there is no sign of Ronda Rousey at this time. So you get DiBiase and Taylor teamed up here. And I've always joked that Terry Taylor is like the low-rent Ted DiBiase. And the most obvious part of that is when he became the tailor-made man in WCW in early 1992, where he was wearing the DiBiase-styled suits, and it was just plainly obvious. But they're also connected in other ways, too. They're on one of my favorite Survivor Series teams of all time, from 1988, the team that I like to call Team Mid-South UWF, which was Big Boss Man, of course, Big Bubba Rogers, who would eventually be a UWF champion. Akeem, who used to be the one-man gang, a UWF champion. Ted DiBiase, one of the mainstays of Watts' promotion for so many years, as I've established many times now. Terry Taylor as the Red Rooster. And Haku. And you're not going to tell Haku that he can't be on the team because he wasn't in the UWF, because who is going to go up and tell Haku he can't be anywhere he wants to be? Another similarity between DiBiase and Taylor is they both came into the WWF as, I guess, nominal baby faces in the case of Terry Taylor. I've established the DiBiase one in the special from last week. Both of them turned on Sam Houston to become heels early in their run. Terry Taylor did so. He was still known as Terry Taylor. He was kind of going by Scary Terry Taylor. I don't know. He wasn't very scary to me. He turned on Sam Houston, I believe it was the August 1st, 1988 episode of Primetime Wrestling. I don't know if it's on the network yet, and I probably should check that out, but I'm a little bit mad at the network right now. So do check that out. There was a tag match where Terry Taylor turned on Sam Houston himself. Now, these two teams had an awesome match later in 1986. I actually save it on YouTube so that I can easily go back and watch it whenever. It was a whipping match, and I can't remember who brought it to my attention back when, but when I watched it that first time, I was so taken by it that I saved it. And I'll probably throw it into the footnotes for this show, which, if you follow me on Twitter, I reply to my initial post saying the new episode is out with some footnotes on this sort of thing. So that's where I put in the stuff like this, because I'm a little bit more adept, as I said there, than I am on Facebook. Now, DiBiase does a very unique thing that I liked a lot here. He's in the ring with Roberts, and he grabs Buddy's arm, like, to do an arm bar, but he just kind of brings him over to the corner and has Roberts' arm tag Michael Hayes. So he's forcing Hayes into the ring so they could settle the issue there. And Ted dominates Hayes for a little while, and then both of them tag out. And we get Taylor and Buddy Roberts back in there. And we get a head scissors sequence, which was okay, except I was really bothered by the fact that Taylor's shoulders were on the mat for well over 3 seconds, and he wasn't rolling a shoulder over. And I thought it was a bad job by the referee there to not be counting Taylor down. Taylor, I thought, was going to end up as a face in peril, but he actually cuts it off with a back elbow. And then we get Ted and Michael Hayes back in there again, and DiBiase really seems to have the number of Michael P.S. Hayes, no E, but Hayes does get a boot up in the corner on a DiBiase charge. JR makes reference to the world title tournament, which had actually, I'm not sure when UWF TV aired in the various markets. This one is labeled May 31st, 86, which was the Saturday afternoon. It's traditional for these shows to label it on the Saturday. But on the Friday, you had the world title tournament, and that was when Gordy won, but they said that they'll update the audience next week on that. So that's certainly a timing issue. DiBiase does fire up with some of those right hands. He's not wearing the glove, by the way. I just should throw that in there. And we get a double elbow by DiBiase and Taylor. And the referee is totally out of position here. So I give him low marks for this match. We get a sunset flip by Terry Taylor. And he gets punched trying to drag the Freebird down. Taylor does that thing where he goes for a body slam and then either kind of slips or overcompensates. And that ends up being a two count. But then he gets a nice atomic drop, Taylor does, on Buddy Roberts. And then a double atomic drop by DiBiase and Taylor on Roberts. Same move. And Rick Rude gets all the attention for his atomic drop sell, but Buddy Roberts had a pretty good one as well, where he would kind of hit the mat and he would hop up and then land on his ass again. And that happened twice. But then we get a low blow on DiBiase, and they end up outside the ring. And Hayes teases a pile driver on DiBiase on the floor, a direct callback to the 1981 angle in Georgia Championship Wrestling. And as I said in the DiBiase special, that was a feud between him and the Freebirds that carried on for so many years and across promotions. And I love that was kept up across different areas. DiBiase actually blocks the pile driver, and Taylor is a little late in coming over and helping. Back inside, though, we get a neck breaker by Buddy Roberts on DiBiase as JR points out that Ted has had chronic neck problems dating back to the 1981 pile driver. And of course, it would be actual neck issues that would force Ted DiBiase out of active competition in the summer of 1993. I couldn't tell. It kind of looked like DiBiase was bleeding or something. I couldn't really tell. Again, another video quality issue. But he blocks a suplex, the vertical suplex, and Ted scores with one of his own. And both guys tag out, and it's Taylor and Roberts in the ring now. And the Freebirds are whipped into each other. They do the corner whip, and they run into each other in the center of the ring. And we set up our finish here, which is Taylor getting Roberts in an O'Connor roll, and Hayes comes over and nails him with a clothesline. And with Taylor down, Hayes lifts Roberts up like a front suplex to kind of slam Buddy down onto Taylor. And it looks like they get a 1-2-3 there. But this is a really strange finish that left me scratching my head, as a second referee came into the ring and disqualified the Freebirds here. And maybe I missed something here. Perhaps somebody could fill me in. And yeah, maybe it was some excess double teaming, but where does the second ref have the jurisdiction to come in and make this kind of call? I don't know if there was a referee officiating structure. Of course, Watts had a lot of weird rules in his territory, most famously in WCW 92, but I may not be familiar with all those. You know, in doing a UWF show, which was before my time as a fan, and also, you know, not a promotion that I had seen much on TV, sometimes I fear that I was out kicking my coverage here, but I do think it's kind of a sloppy ending. Maybe it's a let's keep the fans happy and give the babyfaces the win by DQ because we had just done the really hot angle. But it didn't really sit well with me, the finish there. You could have had Taylor get pinned and just give the Freebirds the victory, and the issue would continue on. Like I said, they had that whipping match later in the year, so it's not like the feud would die because Terry Taylor gets pinned at the hands of a cheap double team of the Fabulous Freebirds. Sharp-dressed man is an appropriate theme for the UWF Tag Team Champions, the Fantastics. An example of a tag team that I myself probably do not appreciate enough. I've liked a lot of their work in Crockett in 1988. That match at the first Clash of Champions with the Midnight Express is one of my favorite Clash of Champions matches, because it's almost like an ECW match transported into Jim Crockett 1988. And it's also weird because Jim Cornette is there participating in what is almost like a hardcore match at times. And they're the tag champs here, and they're taking on the Koloffs. And the Fantastics would come down. They would hug and kiss women around the ring. I always thought that was a little weird. But, you know, they were always kind of like the alternate Rock and Roll Express. Neither one of those guys, Tommy Rogers or Bobby Fulton, were on the level of Ricky Morton. I do think they were probably both, in terms of their individual talents, maybe a little bit better than Robert Gibson. So it's one of those things, I guess, those two teams will always be linked in my mind for being rather similar, but both highly successful. And of course, because the Russians are out there, there's Eddie Gilbert once again. He is all over this show. And this is amazing. He actually did a wardrobe change, which I'm not going to begrudge him. He was doing some hard work there earlier, laying the chain down to Bill Watts. I mean, hell, I'm not above wardrobe changes. When I went to U2 a couple weeks ago, I knew it was going to be 85 degrees in the parking lot, so I actually brought a change of shirt because I didn't want to go into the show all sweaty or whatever. And Eddie has changed into a black Hawaiian shirt. I thought that was a neat little number. And he's there just to brag about what he's done to Cowboy Bill Watts. And we just get a brawl starting out, and it's kind of a tornado brawl. In fact, the match really never gets formally started here. And we get a 3-on-2, because you have Korchenko there with Ivan and Nikita, that eventually goes into a 4-on-2, because Eddie has decided to help out. And I'm just watching Eddie Gilbert through this entire show. And, you know, having not seen some of his work in the various territory, I mean, I'm blown away by what he's doing here. And I remember Alan, one of the co-hosts of Letters from Center Stage, and before that, Letters from Kayfabe, bringing up the point, can you imagine if Eddie Gilbert, who unfortunately passed away in 1995, if Eddie Gilbert was alive today, the podcast that he would do, because this is a guy who gave no craps about anything, and he was willing to shoot straight at all times. And you got everybody with a podcast now, I guess me too, but I'm not part of the business. I'm talking, you got a J.J. Dillon podcast now. You got Tony Schiavone coming back. You got Bruce Pritchard. Everybody's got a podcast. And can you imagine what an Eddie Gilbert podcast would sound like, where he's talking about working Continental in the late 80s or in the Watts territory or even WWF in 1983, which is the stuff that I'd love to hear about. Of course, he had the car accident there that really derailed him, and he left in 84. He's on some of the early 84 WWF TVs. And we get the brawl. So, of course, it's a 4-on-2. And you're like, okay, well, who's going to make the save here? We got Dr. Death. He's already put in a full day's work here with his match. You had DiBiase and Taylor. They literally just had their match. Duggan, I don't know where he is. So we get Cowboy Bill Watts making the, I guess it's called the Little Drummer Boy Yankee Doodle Dandy comeback. I know it was in one of those leaked WWE memos that came out about the rules at house shows. Well, Watts makes the big comeback. He's got his head all bandaged up and everything, and he's got a baseball bat. And he helps clear the ring here. And the biggest thing that I learned here is that Watts is a right-handed hitter, because you if you want to swing at those Russians, you want to do it with your strong side. I don't think he was a switch hitter, because I know that Ivan, Nikita, and all them are right-handed, so you would only want to bat right-handed against the left-handed. Anyway, I'm digressing. I'm trying to cram in baseball references where they probably are not warranted. But Bill Watts making the big comeback here, and I questioned to myself whether it was right to have Bill Watts on the same show where he got beat down 20 minutes before. And I guess it makes sense within the context of the story. You are showing him all bandaged up. You are showing him with a weapon so that he can help clear the ring. I guess I'm okay with it. it might have been better if you could have held it over to the next week's programming and he makes the comeback then. Although the way they would present the TV is a week has passed since then and maybe he wouldn't have all the bandages and such a week later. And the bandages kind of give off that effect of the guy making the comeback with the big injury or whatever. But it doesn't harm my enjoyment of the angle or this show in general, because that's where the credits come up for the end of the program. And damn, this is some mighty tasty UWF television here today. And I do want to thank the person who uploaded this, whoever it was. I don't want to name names or anything, because God, I want people to be able to see this stuff. And I had the idea to do this show, and there was a lot more stuff out on YouTube a month or two ago that is no longer there. And if everything is going to get taken down due to copyright issues, well then I guess I'm just going to have to change the name of the show to Walking in Memphis, where I'll have a Mark Cohn song as my theme at the end, and I'll just only do Memphis stuff because nobody seems to really even friggin' know who owns the footage or anything. So that tends to never get taken down. Hopefully, we never have to resort to that. Now, without any further ado, it's the grand return of YouTube Comment Theater. And we only have 4 comments here, and one of them is rather long, and I'll have to excerpt that one. Our first comment is by Christian Body, and comment is, best TV promotion of all time. And it's certainly a top contender for that award. The values and production were certainly well ahead of its time. And considering that, you know, the stuff they had at hand, they did not have the backing of Dick Ebersol at NBC. What they were able to put together was really, really good. They did music videos ahead of when the WWF was doing it. Of course, they had the rock and wrestling thing in 1984, although that may be coming up on next week's episode. Just stay tuned for that. We also have Jonathan Turbide says, amazing feud between Gilbert, Russians, and Watts and his friends. And yep, it was an amazing feud. Like I said, not the big money draw that they might have hoped, but we can still draw some excitement from it to this day. Steven Bianchi says, oh man, Eddie just came out for the first promo and now I know what this episode is. This is great stuff. And yep, that's what it is. And Kathleen G has the last comment here, and it's rather long, so I'm going to have to excerpt this. Legendary angle. Look at how they teased the angle by having Eddie come out first during the Steiners match, then making his ultimatum that he's not leaving until Watts comes out. Then we were shocked to see Ivan and Nikita burst in and attack Watts. At the time, this was huge because Ivan and Nikita were wrestling for the Crockett promotion. So their angle really legitimized the angle. Their presence really legitimized the angle and made Eddie look like $1 million. And it goes into the Korchenko story that I had said earlier. This may have been Eddie's high point, as he was at his heel best and he was reaching more people because UWF was Watts' attempt at going nationwide. And I do think this is probably the absolute height of Eddie Gilbert from a creative perspective. Now, I know that there's probably stuff that I don't know as well from Memphis. He did a lot of neat stuff with Lawler, fighting in parking lots, and stuff like that. And there's probably a lot that I'm missing. So my call to you is bring that stuff to my attention, because I want more cool Eddie Gilbert stuff as part of my life. And I would love to do an Eddie Gilbert Memphis show down the road. You know, whatever. Just bring it to my attention. Suggestions of things that I should watch are always appreciated, instead of me just kind of mining through YouTube aimlessly, which is really what I do on a regular basis. And that'll do it for YouTube Comment Theater. Now, for next week's show, I had mentioned the rock and wrestling connection, and I said you might want to stay tuned for that. And next week I'll be doing a show that I've wanted to do for quite a while. As when I was going through my journey of 1984 WWF TV last summer, this is one of the episodes that really stood out to me, and it's a pretty loaded show. It is WWF Championship Wrestling from June 16th, 1984. And there are a lot of interesting things that we'll be seeing on this program. We have Tito Santana as the Intercontinental Champion taking on Cowboy Bob Orton. So you get two named guys in a match there. There's also another match with two named guys that features my favorite guy from 84 WWF, Dr. D. David Schultz, taking on my least favorite guy from 1984 WWF, Brian Blair. We have Jesse the Body Ventura, who had just made his way back to the WWF. He is in action as well. We have one of the great Paul Orndorff squashes of all time against Rudy Diamond. And yes, this is the one where Rudy Diamond wears the shirt that says Paula, and Orndorff becomes enraged by that. Do tune in to find out what happened there. And in Piper's Pit, after a lengthy buildup of some 6-7 weeks in the pit, we have Cyndi Lauper joining Rowdy Roddy Piper. And Cyndi Lauper was the number one music artist. Her song was at number one that week in 1984. So it was an amazing accomplishment to get her on WWF TV, and her role in the Rock and Wrestling Connection cannot be understated, and that role of Captain Lou Albano as well, who is a massive part of the Piper's Pit that'll be on next week. So do tune in. It's been a lot of fun mining through Bill Watts' land, but we're back to Vince McMahon country, although he's actually not on next week's show as a broadcaster because his father had passed away shortly before that. He had Vince Sr. had passed away in late May of 1984. So it's Gene Okerlund and friends, who I have said that I'm not particularly a fan of Okerlund on commentary, either color or play-by-play. So we'll see how it goes. But do tune in next week for another exciting episode in actual Allentown of Greetings from Allentown.